Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Seymour Hersh, who's one of the country's most acclaimed investigative reporters. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1969 for the expose of the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. He has a new book, Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. We'll be talking to him in a moment. We'll also talk with Edward Luttwak, who's an internationally recognized authority on preventive diplomacy. He's the author of Strategy, The Logic of War and Peace. And he has an opinion piece recently in the New York Times, Time to Quit Iraq. So we'll be talking to him about his offer strategic plan for extricating America from what many people think is one of the worst foreign policy disasters in this nation's history. And then we'll talk with Lawrence O'Donnell, who's an Emmy Award-winning producer of NBC's The West Wing. He's also MSNBC's senior political analyst and a panelist on the McLaughlin Group. He also was a former Democratic Chief of Staff at the United States Senate Committee on Finance and for the United States Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. And we're talking to Lawrence O'Donnell about the presidential campaign and perhaps what advice he may have for John Kerry, since everybody seems to be weighing in that area. Let's now go to the first guest. I'm speaking with Seymour Hersh, who's one of the most acclaimed investigative reporters in the United States. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his 1969 expose of the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. He's written 8 books, and the latest is a new book, Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. And Seymour Hersh, how is it, particularly in the age of digital cameras, that people obviously high up in our government thought that you could break the Geneva Convention on torture and somehow get away with it? What were they thinking?
Well, one thing, of course, is the first thing you have to understand about the White House is, in all fairness to them, nobody knew what was happening specifically in Abu Ghraib. They didn't know about the insanity of what was happening on the night shift. That doesn't mean that there wasn't an awful lot of awareness of abuses from the very beginning that were not stopped and an abusive policy that was not ever rolled back. But one of the things they do in this White House that's so difficult for a journalist is they have their own definition. For example, they have their own definition of what torture is. They have their own definition of what abuse is. The United States not only is a signatory to the Geneva Convention, but also to various federal laws. We've joined international laws and with congressional votes on joining certain treaties and other agreements that defined abuse very carefully, but this White House has its own definition. I can just tell you, torture, for example, in one paper given by a lawyer in the Justice Department, you can do grievous injury to the limbs and body of a person and perhaps even causing death, but it isn't necessarily torture if your intent in doing so was to protect America, the national interest.
But still, knowing the military as you do, the military don't do things without taking orders. So there has to be, and of course, your book is called Chain of Command. How could this have happened? And how could you have created this ambiguity with people who are in fact used to following orders, and they must know about the Geneva Convention? It's not exactly a state secret.
The war begins. 9/11 happens. We're angry. We're scared. We don't know we're going to strike again. If you remember, the fear was very palpable. John Walker Lynn, everybody I'm sure will remember that hapless 20-year-old boy from California who was discovered to be with the Taliban, remember?
Mm-hmm.
He was subjected to immediate horrible treatment. He was stripped naked, tied to a board. He had a bullet that wasn't removed for days. GIs were allowed to jeer him, paint stuff on him, take photographs of him nude. He was thrown into basically a dungeon. And for days, the mistreatment was palpable, not an outcry, because we're in the revenge mode. What the administration did is one of the things I write, I conclude my book by saying, we have a president who really, I think he believes when he says, we do not do torture. I think he believes the words he uses when he utters them. But they have no meaning beyond the immediacy of that moment. For example, he has said publicly he's against torture, but meanwhile, I can tell you, you're right about one thing. The chain of command is very sensitive. The people in the audience who've know anybody in the military, been in the military, understand if you're a company, a platoon commander, or a company commander, or a battalion, or a brigade, or a division, or the chief of staff, or the secretary of defense, or the president, or the vice president, if you set the rules very clearly and very, very explicitly from the beginning, there will be no abuse of prisoners, because you don't get good intelligence that way, which happens to be a fact. You get it from establishing rapport, not coercion. If you had set that from top to bottom, I'm slamming my hand against the table, it would have gone right through. But instead, everybody looked away. And so now we have these investigations and these hearings, and people talk about Army regulations and field manuals and legal briefs. None of them have anything to do, because the reality is you could do what you want to a prisoner as long as you didn't get caught.
So there is no, to your mind, you don't think that at the top of the chain of command, there was any kind of secret finding?
Well, there was a secret understanding. No, quite the contrary. I think what happened is, at the top of the command, they promulgated some rules that said, in essence, they told the soldiers doing the interrogation, it was very clear. They said that detainees, or the people we captured from Afghanistan, members of Al Qaeda, did not deserve any respect from the Geneva Convention, because they were not a state. They were a stateless group of terrorists.
That's the Gonzalez finding.
Yes, and the president publicly said, I support this finding, this is correct, but nonetheless, he said, consistent, you know, with good military necessity, I will uphold the Geneva Convention, consistent with military necessity. Well, in this case, that meant that basically the military were given a reasonably free hand, and we then promulgated a set of rules. Again, the point is to get caught up in whether one general said we can dunk people underwater for 3 seconds at a time or 4 seconds isn't the issue. The issue is that there was almost a misunderstanding of how do you get good intelligence. The problem is good intelligence only comes from seduction, not from coercion.
But in a strategic sense, we didn't have any intelligence on that country just before we even went in. I mean, I spoke to a handful of people who speak Arabic, people like Graham Fuller and others, who knew the country, and they said before this war started it would be a quick victory followed by a slow defeat. It seems that we're actually having a quick victory followed by a quick defeat.
If 2 years is quick. You know, in the book, I quote, I spent some time with a very high-level Iraqi officer who somehow wasn't captured. And he was known to the United Nations people when they worked there at UNSCOM, when they did the inspections. And after the war began, contact was established, and this officer came out to visit me with me for 3 days in Damascus. And he told me in enormous detail about the planning before 9/11 Saddam had made in case we invaded. They were going to set up small cells, begin an insurgency, almost amazingly what did happen. And we had no intelligence. Part of the problem, part of the reason we got in such trouble with Abu Ghraib was the chronic lack of intelligence. Despite the treatment of the prisoners at Guantanamo, Al-Qaeda and others, we didn't learn anything about how they operated, how Al-Qaeda and the dissidents even operated in Afghanistan. We're still facing a huge counterinsurgency in that part of the world, where both the Taliban and some remnants of the Al-Qaeda are still very much in control of the south and east of Afghanistan. I mean, it's a real zoo there, and which is sort of ignored the other war, I call it.
So you go from the vengeance or the emotional reaction to 9/11, and now you're in Iraq and to a lesser extent Afghanistan, and it's because you can't find out any intelligence, you don't know who's shooting at you, you employ torture out of frustration.
Yes, and there was a little more subtle than that. And when what happened is, in the fall of 2000, in August of last year, 4 months or 5 months after the war began, we were in real trouble. The UN was blown up. The Jordanian embassy was blown up. There was no water, no electricity. The oil pipelines were being hit. And it was clear that we were getting into a year before the election, and there were real, real problems. And so at this point, they decided to get tough with the prisoner population in Iraq. Although, unlike at least in Afghanistan, the people in Guantanamo, they were picked up in the battlefield. Here in Iraq, many of the people arrested, as even the military's own estimate is 60% of those arrested early in the after March of 2003 were people caught up in roadblocks or in just taken from homes. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, I think their estimate was more like 90%. It's amazing, the numbers. Anyway, the point is that the war was going badly. We decided to get tough with the prisoner population. At this point, I write about a special commando unit that was set up with enormous secrecy, illegally, by Rumsfeld to go capture, disappear people anywhere in the world. It's still going on, this unit. And this unit was brought in from the field where they've been operating for a year and a half without anybody knowing anything about them. They were brought into Iraq and into the prison system, and they had one thought, and this thought is interesting. The thought was, get some young men who were Iraqi citizens, not in the insurgency, photograph them nude, which is a violation of, it's just being exposed nude is a violation of the Koran. Get photographs of them simulating sexual acts, et cetera, a lot of photographs, and tell them, either you go home, we'll send you home, go back to your village, find the insurgency, join it, and report to us. Be our counter and be our double agent for us, or we'll spread these photographs around. That was the idea. I know that idea was used by this group. That was one of their techniques for breaking down people, sexual humiliation. And all I can say to you, because I don't know more than that, they were brought in the fall when everybody in the White House and in the field was in a panic about what's going on. The special unit came to Baghdad. By October, the night shift at Abu Ghraib was going crazy with sexual stuff. And I can assure your audience that reservists from West Virginia, one of them was night manager of a pizza shop, reservists from West Virginia did not understand viscerally that the most direct way, according to psychological and academic studies of the Arab mentality, the most direct way to break down and humiliate an Arab male is to photograph him nude and have women in the photographs to thumbs up, thumbs down. They did not know that on their own. Somebody passed that word. There's much we don't know about happened with Abu Ghraib. Not to say the White House authorized it, but what happened was almost... I won't say ineluctable, because it wasn't ineluctable, you know, it didn't have to happen, but certainly a not impossible consequence of the American activity. From the very beginning, the refusal of the chain of command, the men in charge, and the Condoleezza Rice, I write about meetings she had about this issue in 2002, to do anything about it.
Well, you're also describing a psychological tactic which pimps use against their whores. I mean...
I can tell you is I read about it, but I'll take your word for it.
Remind the audience again that I'm speaking with Seymour Hersh, the author of Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. And Seymour Hersh is one of the country's most acclaimed investigative reporters. He won a Pulitzer Prize for the expose of the My Lai massacre in Vietnam and has been writing regularly about the Afghanistan and the Iraq War in The New Yorker. But in terms of what changed in Iraq, wasn't the change brought about by General Miller, who was brought in from Gitmo? They wanted to Gitmoize. In other words, the first hapless bunch of people we scooped up, we sent to this island of Cuba. And wasn't that... then he came into Iraq, didn't he, after...
Well, but it's... yes, but one of the things that I took that issue and made it more complicated, because everything is always... the more you learn, and I'm nowhere near a definitive picture. Mm-hmm. Miller was brought into... Miller joined... was an artillery officer, actually, working in the Southern
Command. As is Tommy Franks.
Was he? That's right.
Yeah, and so was right. General Westmoreland.
he was an artillery officer. It was in the fall of 2002 because nothing good was happening at that prison. By that I mean we weren't getting good intelligence out of it. And I begin the book with a meeting in the White House on that issue. And with the idea there were some people in the White House who were very concerned about the abuses that were going on, the mistreatment of prisoners, the lack of good intelligence. And, you know, and military people who worked in the White House were always, you know, for them it's a real simple ratio, which is you only treat their prisoners the same way you want our prisoners treated. So the idea of mistreating prisoners when we were in the middle of one war in Afghanistan and beginning and planning another one in Iraq was very troubling to the military men, and appropriately so. And nothing came out of this concern. And instead, Miller, even though the concern about mistreatment and wrong people being unlawfully and wrongfully detained, nothing happened, although it went to the level of Condoleezza Rice and Rumsfeld. And the most amazing thing is, after all this concern was raised in September and October, of that month or a month later in November, Miller was sent in to get tougher and got tougher on the prisoners with more, you know, again, we don't know all the details. And it was that Miller, this General Miller, who was sent to Iraq in August. But at the same time, the special unit I'm writing about, it was known as a special access program or SAP. This program also was brought in, working with Miller and some people in military intelligence. It was a very a significant increase planned of applying more pressure to the detainees, to the Iraqis. And again, the problem was that nobody was sensitive to the fact that most of the people detained in Iraq had nothing to do, even a higher percentage than those that were detained in Afghanistan. So you're mistreating a bunch of people that have nothing to do with being against America. And as somebody said in one of these reports, if they weren't Al Qaeda when we capture them, you know, they will be when we're done with them.
But again, pulling back a bit, Seymour Hersh, still it seems we got into that war with strategic blindness, and we've been conducting the war with tactical blindness, and. The bottom line, it seems to me, is that we lost that war a couple of days after we won it. We've never been able to give the Iraqi people any confidence that the bad guys aren't going to go away. And indeed, you mentioned that you spoke with an Iraqi general who said that Saddam planned for this outcome and prepositioned cells and materiel, which is obvious. There's obviously plenty of weaponry and plenty of coordination. So why is it that this sucking wound, this geopolitical humiliation that this country is going through, is not on the front burner in this presidential race?
I think I'm glad you're asking me, but I think it's a misdirected question. You know, that, please get John Kerry on the phone.
Well, I mean, is it because he's afraid to criticize a war while our boys and girls are fighting it?
I can't imagine. Look, I can't speak for John Kerry, obviously, and none of us can. But I can certainly say that this is a war that is much more unpopular than many polls and others would indicate. There are many, it's very unpopular in the military, very unpopular among conservative Republicans as well as all Democrats. It's a very unpopular war because there's no way out. It's a, you said sucking wound. There's absolutely no, this administration has no exit plan, absolutely none. And of course, Kerry's, one of his statements was that absolutely baffled me. He said when he's elected, he was going to go to the leaders, European leaders, and say, send your troops there. I think the notion that France or Germany are going to send their young boy to die, to change the color of the corpses, is ludicrous. Of course, that's not a solution. What we need is, I think if he were to, declare that he was going to find a way to get out of that war as fast as possible and save more American lives and more Iraqi lives. And I think that would be great. Instead, we hear talk about from the Republicans about an election. That's, phantasmagorical. There's an election. Who's going to go to stand in a poll? Who wants to join the army tomorrow in Iraq? They'll be blown up. The insurgency, we simply don't have a handle at all on it, and we haven't.
But do you believe, Seymour Hersh, that it was so clear that the press were caught up in the drumbeat for war? Fox, in particular, it became almost like a game show. Subsequently, the New York Times and the Washington Post have done a mea culpa in terms of not looking harder at the claims and justifications for going in. Of course, the ground has always been shifting there. But I don't believe that in general in this country, you're saying the American people have disquiet and aren't happy with this war. I don't think they know how bad it is. I mean, it seems that most have bought into this notion of sovereignty change, that somehow it's Alawi's problems, not George W. Bush's.
Of course, and none of us know what anybody else thinks. I don't know what the president thinks or Condoleezza Rice. We don't know what they know. And one of the things you learn in Washington is you can write about a meeting at which documents and conversation takes place, but you don't know what the National Security Advisor draws away from it. They have an incredible capacity to not hear what they don't want to hear. But I think the American public has extreme misgivings about this war. I don't think anybody even casually, it's something a lot of people aren't tuned into. They may as the election nears. But when they are tuned in, it's more body parts flying from another ambush or a suicide bomber. And I shouldn't say I disagree. I just have a different take on it, which doesn't make my take any more right than yours is.
But you've been doing some really interesting work for The New Yorker in terms of analyzing perhaps the post-war strategy in particular. One of the ironies is this seems to be a country that we're fighting for that perhaps doesn't want to be a country, and our boys and girls are dying to bring freedom to people who don't appear to want freedom. And it seems that in one of your pieces in The New Yorker, you were suggesting that Israel sees the writing on the wall, that in fact this blunder has emboldened and strengthened Iran, and that they're doing damage control with the Turks in the Kurdistan, anticipating a disintegration of Iraq, which is what the Royal Institute in London recently said, and which is what the recent NIE that the New York Times got leaked, the National Intelligence Estimate, also indicated that's probably the way it's going.
Well, what I've been doing actually is sort of writing an alternative history of the war based on information from inside. There are people, obviously, who don't want to go public because, 23 years in the armed forces, they have a house, a mortgage, a dog, a cat, and 3 children in school, so they don't want to go public. And that's the perception. What I'm doing is basically reflecting the perception from inside. This is an operation that's not sustainable. Among other things, we can't sustain the special operations forces that are there, can't sustain operating at this tempo for another year. Our armed forces are played out. The casualties, if you forget about the killed, the wounded, we had, 1,000 wounded last month. I mean, they're enormous, and the wounds are gaping, sucking wounds, to use that phrase again, because, we have better body armor. And so people lose limbs and parts of the brains and parts of the face. It's really disastrous and ghastly with the kind of wounds we are seeing in this war. And at enormous sociological and economic cost to all of us, too, but also, obviously, human cost, too. And so, you and I can lament about it, but the bottom line is that there are still 6 weeks left to the election. Nothing good is going to happen in Iraq, no matter how the White House tries to paint it and spin it. And maybe people, as they get closer, will pay more attention. So, ultimately, this may be a Bush versus Bush campaign. It's hard to believe it, but people may just vote against Bush more than voting for Kerry. And if that's so, that could squeak him through. But he sure looks like he's in trouble now.
But you also, just in closing, you mentioned that the uniformed military and the intelligence professionals are in a state of disquiet, or perhaps, some people even suggest near mutiny, and I interviewed Anonymous recently. So clearly there's something going on there. So do you think that that's something that Kerry could use, the notion that a lot of our uniformed military and intelligence professionals have lost the faith, trust, and confidence in their commander-in-chief?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say near mutiny. One of the things that's sort of amazing about this war and very interesting to me is, of course, the armed forces have performed under terrible conditions very well. I mean, there's always been some of the tactics they use, which are horrible and wrong-headed, but that's not their call. And the American public, unlike the way the public behaved towards the American troops in Vietnam, are not blaming the soldiers. The American public, those who are tuned in, knows that whatever's going on there is not the fault of the GRA or even the young officers there. I don't think it's an issue for a presidential candidate to get into, because it's got so many problems inherent in it. To start talking about the lack of morale in the armed forces. In the book I did, I fessed up to a story I didn't write. And there was a story I didn't write 2 years ago at the height of the war in Afghanistan, because our troops behaved so badly in the field and ran away, more or less. I just pulled the story. And I had interviewed Wes Clark, the former NATO commander who was then, I don't know what he was doing then, 2 years ago. And he had helped me on the story, had given me some information. And when I ran into him when he was running for president earlier this year, he braced me and he said to me, "Whatever happened to that story we talked about?" And I said, "Whatever you say to a general, sir." I said, "I just thought maybe it wasn't, wrong time, wrong story." And he said, really snapped at me. He said, "Not your call." He said, "You should have run it. It's your obligation. You got to tell the truth. You might make things better." And so that's all we can try and do is, in my case, tell the truth and try and make things better. And I think the politicians have to have the same obligation. But instead, we have an awful lot of trimming and filling and backing. We don't have a lot of direct speech. I'm talking about the Democrats. I think the Republicans, I think the presidential candidate has, he just believes what he says.
Well, but it seems that there is a confluence here where the president and the White House don't want to take casualties, and the military themselves, I don't believe, are very happy being there and going out on patrol and being exposed to people shooting at them. And there's so to that extent, they're ceding a lot to the insurgency simply because of the politics of the moment. But isn't there a plan on November the 7th to have a major offensive?
Well, they're talking in the New York Times today. There was a story about it, and it says late in the year we're going to have an offensive. But what are they going to do?
Right.
Well, they've been bombing increasingly, steadily increasing the force, and they're going to go bomb Fallujah, and the insurgents will move out. A lot of civilians will get killed. The Americans will sweep through. We're not going to occupy Fallujah, and we'll move out eventually, leaving the regular Iraqi army, the much vaulted of Iraqi army. And as soon as we move out, the insurgents will come back and take it back. It's, you know, let me tell you, the 200 octane fuel that drives this insurgency is us. That's the issue. We got to figure a way to get us out of there. Maybe those people can start working it out. They have a lot of oil to share. Maybe they can do something, but not with us there.
Well, as it happens, our next guest has a plan for us to get out.
Well, that's great.
Thank you for joining us.
No problem. Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Seymour Hersh, who's an investigative reporter. He has a recent book, Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. I'm now speaking with Edward Luttwak, who's an internationally recognized authority on preventive diplomacy, geoeconomics, and strategy. He's based at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., and the author of Strategy, The Logic of War and Peace, and also Coup d'État, which has been published into 14 languages. His recent op-ed in the New York Times is entitled, Time to Quit Iraq, Sort of. So tell me, how did we get into a war trying to make a country out of a country that may not want to be a country and having our boys and girls die to give freedom to people who may not want freedom?
Well, I know a lot of the people involved in the decision, and I know them very well, and therefore I'm even more puzzled than you are about how such a thing could have been done. You see, the idea of removing Saddam Hussein from power, the idea of decapitating that regime, that had something to be said for it. And in fact, there was a widely discussed Air Force plan, a strike plan, to sort of descend on Baghdad in one fell swoop and knock out the regime. But to go from there to the occupation of a large country full of people who, as you say, are interested in all kinds of things other than what we are proposing to them, to go to that is extraordinary. And I wrote articles at the time asking who were the Democrats in Iraq that we were supposed to liberate and so on. But I have no answer for this. It's somebody thought it was a wonderful idea at the time. That's as far as I can tell. And once they seized on the idea, they systematically closed the decision-making circle and excluded anybody who actually knew anything about the Middle East. I mean, they excluded the State Department expertise, CIA expertise, and they made the decision among themselves. This is how it always happens when these great, enormous errors of policy are made.
But I think it's pretty clear to probably most Americans, even though it's an unpopular war, although I think to the extent to which we've bought, and the press seems to have bought in the idea, into this idea that there's been a change of sovereignty, that it's some, you know, it's becoming Alawi's problem, not Bush's problem. I think the bottom line with it seems to me, Edward Luttwak, is that this mistake, this George W. Bush's mistake, has become our problem. And although your suggestions are very, very novel and I think too novel for this rather unimaginative government to try, the bottom line is that what would really happen if you follow your advice, which you might want to sort of give a brief sketch on, and they call the bluff. In other words, we do pull out. What happens?
Well, first of all, my proposal is that to take advantage of something that is not a good thing but a bad thing. The bad thing is that if the United States were to withdraw tomorrow, then anarchy is inevitable. And Iraq splitting in different parts, which is not necessarily a bad thing, since it was only put together artificially, but also probably into warring parts. And certainly the Sunni, the so-called Sunni triangle, which is much more than a triangle, but generally speaking, northern Iraq would come under the control of maybe Sunni Arab groups in most places, but there would also be, of course, some of them will happen to be Islamists. Others might be Baathists. Others might be tribal. The Kurds would revert to the Kurdistan they've had for the last 10 years, and nothing terrible would happen there. But in the south, the Shia, of course, are deeply divided, divided in many different ways. A lot of them are, in fact, very new Shia. I mean, they only converted in the last couple of generations, and they're quite different from the old ones and so on. So chaos and anarchy. So my idea is that since we would suffer much less from it than Iraq's neighbors, then we ought to be able to obtain things from them. The Iranians have been very unhelpful. They could be very helpful. They would suffer enormously if Iraq were to become anarchical. They might enjoy meddling in its affairs for a bit, but the fact is that they have a lot of enemies, and these enemies would find bases in Iraq. That goes for Turkey as well. Turkey has done very little to help. Turkey would suffer a great deal from an anarchical Iraq on its border. Certainly Kuwait. I mean, the Kuwait has experienced a huge revenue increase because oil prices have gone up. Plus, Kuwaiti contractors are made out like bandits, if that's the right word, in contracting or subcontracting for U.S. taxpayers' expense. And Kuwait has done nothing or very little to help. And they could do a lot. And the same goes for Saudi Arabia. Now, in other words, all of Iraq's neighbors would be gravely endangered by an anarchical Iraq. And therefore, if the United States were to say to them, look, you are not helping, situation is hard, we're going to leave, you live with the anarchy, we're going to be 12,000 miles away. At that point, they should be forthcoming, and they should be able to willing to do a lot of things that should make it much easier to cope with the situation there.
Well, at this point, there is meddling going on, as you alluded to. The Iranians, at least the Revolutionary Guards, appear to be running this Muqtada al-Sadr as kind of a Hezbollah-type surrogate. And the Saudis, even whatever the government tells us, the Wahhabis are in there helping in Fallujah and other places and providing a lot of the suicide bombers. Now,
you're quite right. I mean, everybody's having a free ride right now. Since the United States is publicly committed to staying in Iraq until all is well, they're having a free ride. We have U.S. troops fighting in the north of Iraq to prevent Baathists from restoring a Sunni supremacy over the Shia. And so we're fighting in the north to help the Shia. And in the south, Shia attack us, or at least some of them do, and the vast majority of Shia do nothing about it. So they're free riding. So they say, oh, the Americans are going to be here anyway. So yes, we can attack them. We don't need to help the Americans at all, even though they're helping us. And if you put on the table the option of withdrawal, that changes. If we are able to tell the Shia, say, listen, You talk as if you want us to leave. Right. If we all leave, you know what's going to happen? The Shia majority will come under the rule of the Sunni minority all over again. It wasn't by accident that in centuries past, a Sunni minority ruled the Shia, and they'll do it again, simply because of the fact that the Shia are so divided, and the Sunni tend to have a self-image as martial and, you know, the ruling race, master race self-image they have in Iraq. All these mustached men with their horses and so on. So we, right now, everybody's free-riding. Free-riding on our determination to stay there. If we just raise the possibility that we might just leave, I think things would change.
Edward Luttwak, what about if in this election that's coming up in January, although there's some doubt and the United Nations doesn't think it's practical, but assuming they go ahead with this election that the White House has been touting lately, why not put on the ballot? Do you want the Americans to stay or leave? Make it a referendum.
Well, that's a novel suggestion. I suppose in one way or another, this will be of course, the issue. In this election, if you're an Iraqi politician, how would you run in this election? Of course, you're going to run on an anti-American platform, because to Iraqis, the notion... See, Iraqis would never dream themselves of going 12,000 miles to help anybody else, to remove dictatorship over somebody else or any other positive purpose. The only thing that the Iraqis would understand going abroad for would be to raid and loot territory, as happened in Kuwait. When the Iraqis invaded Kuwait, that was the one thing Saddam did that was, in fact, popular, because the Iraqi soldiers came back with their little gifts and things that they had picked up in Kuwait. So then, the notion that Americans are in Iraq for any but sinister purposes. Some people say we're there to steal the oil, however absurd that might seem to you. Others are saying that we're there to destroy Islam. Others say there that we are to destroy the principal Arab state because we want to destroy the Arabs. A handful of people, believe the United States is there benevolently. So if you do put this question on the referendum, you know the answer.
Oh, absolutely. If you look at the footage of the car bombings in the street, they blame America for everything and the Jews second.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Sunni extremist Baathist or Islamists put the car bombs and you see on television a Shia cleric, as it was a Shia cleric, explaining that actually it was done by an American helicopter. The Shia cleric is not called upon to explain why on earth the United States would car bomb people queuing up to join the police that the United States is organizing and paying for. But then again, these people are never called upon to explain the logic of their position.
So what would happen then? Just to follow this theoretical idea of a referendum where, you know, you get the vote.
Well, I really, you know, I don't think the referendum would make sense, because the referendum would have an answer. We know the answer,
right?
I think it would simply legitimize. Let's say you had the U.S. administration, including could be the Bush administration, that decides to leave Iraq and leave it to its own devices, then it would be a smart thing to do, to have a referendum, and then you say, oh, well, we wanted to stay, but we believe in democracy, so we are leaving. We're going to teach one lesson of democracy to the Iraqis, that is, we're going to listen to a referendum. But I really don't think that's the productive line to follow, mm-hmm. as compared to the alternative of firmly putting withdrawal on the table and then using it to force Iraq's neighbors to help instead of hurting. Nobody is helping. The Iranians, the Turks, the Saudis, the Kuwaitis could be helpful. The Syrians are the ones who really would like to see the United States abandon, evacuate ignominiously leave with the tail between his legs or his flea or whatever the term is, because that's the Syrian model. That's what happened in Lebanon, and that way the Syrians would hope to have a very strong say in Iraq, probably by helping one faction or the other. But the others are terrified of us leaving, and if so, they should pay and should contribute. Some of them literally contribute. I mean, it's absurd that Kuwait is not... the moment we leave an anarchical Iraq, Kuwait gets blown away.
But you don't have appear to have any faith in the Iraqis' ability to govern themselves. It is, after all, a one-resource-based economy, and it happens that that resource, oil, is in two places, in the Kurdish north and the Shia south. So doesn't that mean that the Sunni in the middle are out of luck?
Well, the Sunni, that was what was wrong with the original plan, you see, from the beginning. The Sunni cannot support democracy. They are against democracy on principle, the Sunni Arab, because they are less than 20% of the population. And as far as they see it, democracy would guarantee forever their loss of their supremacy, which is what they consider the natural state of affairs. They consider supremacy natural regardless of the population. The Shia, of course, there are all kinds of Shia, have all kinds of views, but a majority of Shia, a majority evidently believe that in rule by clerics, unelected clerics. If you want to get serious about this, Shia can point to work done by Arab jurists 1,000 years ago critiquing the Greek idea of democracy, if you want to get really scholarly about it. But either way, for the Shia majority, they have no use for democracy. After all, an elected parliament could, for example, legislate things like allowing the drinking of alcohol or the eating of pork, right? They could make that legal. So, and that contradicts the religion. So from their point of view, it's just a mistake. It's a category mistake. So finally, that leaves the Kurds. And you'll notice that the Kurds, who are wonderful people and who have done extremely well in their Kurdistan, who have built a lot of things, developed very nicely. And nevertheless, the one thing they didn't do was to have an election. The Barazanis, the Talibanis, clearly these names themselves suggest a clan-based, tribal-based. They don't want elections. They've never had elections. So the notion that suddenly in January, all these people who have objections in principle to democratic elections are all going to be happy just because you give them that thing, that seems to me very unlikely.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Edward Ludwig, and for your ideas, which are basically that it's the best way to get the attention of the neighbors who have the most to lose from that situation is for the United States to put on the table that they're prepared to withdraw.
Right. It can't be a bluff, of course.
Of course. I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Edward Ludwig, who is the author of Strategy, the Logic of War and Peace, and his recent op-ed in the New York Times was entitled Time to Quit Iraq, Sort of. I'm now speaking with Lawrence O'Donnell, who's an Emmy Award-winning producer of NBC's The West Wing. He is also MSNBC's senior political analyst and a panelist on the McLaughlin Group. He's the Democratic Chief of Staff of the United States Senate Committee on Finance and for the United States Senate Committee on the Environment, and was a senior advisor to Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan. And Lawrence O'Donnell, why do you think it is that the one issue upon which George W. Bush seems to be the most vulnerable, that is, he's gotten this country into an impossible war that the United States appears to have lost, somehow the Democratic opponent has not been able to talk about this. Has he boxed himself in or have they boxed him in? Why is Iraq not on the table?
I think that he's been boxed in by two things. One is a massive ignorance in the American public. Actually, there's another, it's not exactly ignorance. There's a a belief that is contrary to fact, which is 42% of the American public, 42%, believe that Iraq was strongly involved in the 9/11 attack, not tangentially involved, not clapping for it, not rooting for al-Qaeda, but actively and strongly involved, and that the 9/11 attack could not have occurred without Iraq and Saddam Hussein's help. 42%. Now, in an educated society, that number would, you'd expect to find a number like that, but it should be somewhere in the single digits. It should not be this huge belief. So you begin the day with, no matter what anyone says in this campaign, a minimum of 42% who firmly believe that George W. Bush has done exactly the right thing in Iraq. To that 42%, all you need to do is add 8% of reasonable people who, for a variety of reasonable motivations, including domestic policy or tax policy or all sorts of other things, would prefer the Bush approach to the Kerry approach. That's all you need as a formula for victory. So what you have to remember is that the Kerry campaign is campaigning against an amazing belief that 42% of the public has. And now here's the other much more serious problem when you get into trying to run the Kerry campaign. A majority of Kerry voters, about 52% of the people who favor Kerry, want Kerry to be talking like George McGovern. They want Kerry to be talking about pulling troops out of Iraq as soon as possible. Now, we have an experience with that approach in 1972. That approach won one state. At the point in the Vietnam War, which by that time American involvement was about 9 years old in a very serious way, and we were losing 1,000 soldiers a month, not 1,000 in the total campaign in Vietnam, but 1,000 a month were being lost. And you still couldn't win in 1972, saying, I want to bring the troops home. Americans don't want to bring the troops home before they've won, and Americans are the last people on earth to conclude that they've lost. And so there's another third of Kerry voters, one-third of Kerry voters, who actually want Kerry to be talking tougher than Bush on Iraq, who want Kerry to be basically running the Nixon campaign of 1968, which was to say, the people who got us into this war have made a mess of it, they've made a muddle of it, they don't know how to run it, and they don't know how to run it because Robert McNamara in the Vietnam War, for example, the Donald Rumsfeld of the day, made horrible predictions about the winnability of this thing. They don't know how to win it, and I, John Kerry, will prosecute this war better. And Richard Nixon never, in 1968, said he was going to win that war. He simply gave you the feeling that he would prosecute it more vigorously than Hubert Humphrey would have in continuing the Lyndon Johnson administration, in effect. And so if you're running the Kerry campaign, a third of your voters want to hear how tough Kerry's going to be in Iraq. Half of your voters want to hear how quickly Kerry wants to get the troops home. And now you have to sit down and write a speech for him. That is an incredible challenge. However, I submit today's New York Times. I was never a speechwriter in politics, and I don't know how to write speeches. But Paul Glastras, who was a speechwriter for Bill Clinton, has an op-ed piece in today's New York Times in which he offers three possible paragraphs for a Kerry speech, which I think are exactly right and on target on the matter of Iraq. And I would urge everyone to go to nytimes.com.
Can you just briefly...
He says, for example, that he's got to deal with the fact that Kerry voted for the war. And here's the line he writes for this. I voted to give my president the authority he needed to unite the world in confronting Iraq. He abused that authority, but I trusted him, and I now share responsibility for the failing situation in Iraq. As president, I will take responsibility for fixing it, and that, Mr. President, makes one of us. Now, that is a great speechwriter at work, grabbing the elements that are there in front of us all. We all know Kerry voted for it. What does he have to say about voting for it? He's got to say something about voting for it. And then what does he say about what he's going to do now? And that instantly, to me, sounds bolder and more responsible than President Bush's position. And Glastris has other suggestions along mm-hmm. that line.
Well, now, Lawrence O'Donnell, you mentioned this 1972 election between Nixon and McGovern, and you could argue that that was that the American people were given a choice between a corrupt man who was effective and a decent man who was ineffectual. There's an expression in this country, nice guys finish last, and you get the feeling from this election, even Democrats I speak to have a kind of grudging admiration for Karl Rove, even though he's eviscerating their candidate. So what's going on here in the culture? I mean, look what happened with how CBS got set up by the Dan Bartlett, the White House. At least he contributed to the setup. So are we getting into a point of cynicism here where there's a kind of grudging admiration for these sleazy, you know, they used to say in politics, the race goes to the swiftest, as yeah. in swift boat. Nowadays, you can say the race goes to the sleaziest.
And I think if the Democrats begin to admire that, that is the end of them as a party. I think they did come to admire it, frankly. I think they eventually came to admire the Reagan oversimplification of the world in campaigning, and that became manifest in Bill Clinton's 1992 campaign, which was the most simple-minded Democratic campaign that anyone had ever run, and filled with lies, by the way, that they knew were lies at the time, which was, we're going to do a middle-class tax cut. That was classic Republican tax pandering, and in this case, lying. And Democrats, sadly, felt very rewarded by that campaign's success, which they forget was a three-way campaign's success. Bill Clinton's towering electoral achievement in 1992 was that he got 43% of the vote, and Ross Perot made him president. So it's a bad lesson to learn, because the essence of tyranny is the denial of complexity. And if you just want to think about what is the fundamental public relations mission of this presidency, it is to deny complexity in all things. John Kerry seemed to be the perfect candidate of this moment to be voicing the right level of complexity on the issues for Americans to consider. Iraq is more complicated than the president has said because. And you just need a small paragraph after that. My experience in Vietnam has taught me that not respecting the complications of a policy leads to what? And you fill in that paragraph. Especially for the younger voter, the huge collapse in support for Kerry has come in the younger voters, all of whom seem to have no comprehension of the history of Vietnam, and they seem to believe that what Kerry did when he got back from Vietnam was dishonorable, and they don't seem to understand that what Kerry did when he got back from Vietnam saved more lives in Vietnam than anyone else in the American military.
But to Lawrence O'Donnell, what you just said, I'd love to hear John Kerry say that.
Yes, and that's where I feel he's missed the big moment, which was as soon as his post-Vietnam record was attacked, what he needed to do was link what he did after the war to the image of what he did in the war, the image of him reaching down and pulling Jim Rassman out of the river and saving his life in Vietnam was what saved Kerry's campaign in Iowa and created a great image for him. But that, to me, was always the minor part of the story. To me, as a kid in high school in Boston at the time, and I was approaching draft age, when John Kerry came back and he then tried to pull all the rest of us who were ripening toward draft age and headed to Vietnam, when he tried to pull all the rest of us out of that war by stopping it, and he succeeded at that, that was a heroism we have never seen in an American politician. There has never been an American politician whose claim of success prior to entering politics was the ending of a war, and an unjust war in which Americans were dying by the tens of thousands and Southeast Asians were dying by the millions.
But Lawrence O'Donnell, when you talk about the simplification of both the George W. Bush and Ronald Reagan, and you recall that Al Gore, who was a very intelligent guy, and every time there was a photo op, he was always hunched over a laptop like Rodin's The Thinker. He was up against George W. Bush, who many people thought was intellectually challenged in those debates, and his simplicity, if you will, won the day. So what's going on here? Is there
was a different era, Ian. That was a non-issue election. The only issue separating those candidates, once you just sideline abortion, which will always separate Democrat and Republican, the only issue was, my prescription drug benefit for Americans over the age of 65 is better than yours. Now, as much as I want to hear complexity recognized in American political debate, the complexity of Medicare prescription drug benefits is absolutely beyond the analysis of anyone in the press, never mind the analytical ability of the voter. That election was nothing but, in terms of the way voters were choosing toward the end, that last 8 or 9% who make that final choice, was nothing but, I like this guy's manner better than that guy's manner. Because in the year 2000, there was nothing really to be fighting about. There wasn't a war on, there wasn't the deficit, there weren't really any governing problems in the United States except how do you get prescription drugs to people over 65 who have trouble affording them. That's the kind of election we will be nostalgic for as this war on terror or war on Islamic militancy goes on into the century.
But to some extent, I thought you were alluding, though, to this kind of dichotomy where, in effect, you have a choice between being, you know, not so much a choice, but whether or not you are an informed citizen or an ignorant consumer. And it seems to me that I thought that was what you're alluding to, that we're heading in that direction with lack of education, and there's an implicit criticism of the press here, because you were saying earlier that we are ignorant about how bad this war is.
Well, I think the press has done everything it could possibly do to communicate to us that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. We have an unreachable 42% who have a religious belief in the evil of Saddam Hussein extending into the collapse of both World Trade Center buildings.
Now, is that the same 42% that believe that the Earth was created 6,000 years ago in 6 days?
Well, I'm sure we don't have 42% who believe that, but obviously I think it's not hard to figure out who's included in that 42% who think that. So there's nothing the press can do about a country in which 42% believe that. I don't think you could find it. There isn't another country in the world that believes that, and there isn't another country in the world that has a press that's even as energetic as ours. So I'm not about to blame the press for that. I think that what we saw in 2000 was, that's what a presidential election looks like in America when there really isn't anything left to fight about. There's now something gigantic worth fighting over, which is, what is your approach to American security in this age of terror? That is a gigantic issue now that's worth fighting about and having different approaches to. And let us hear the arguments for this approach versus that approach. There are several other issues worth fighting about, but that's clearly the number one.
Well, you've given us, left us on a something large to chew on, and I thank you very much for joining us, Lawrence O'Donnell, and good luck tonight with the Emmys.
Thanks, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Lawrence O'Donnell, who's an Emmy-winning producer for NBC's The West Wing. He's a regular on the McLaughlin Report, MSC's senior political analyst. And I thank Mark Maxwell, the engineer, Lewis Vandenberg, the producer, Grant Gruber, and Carol Coote, the assistant producers. And this program and all previous ones is available at ianmasters.org.